And we'll be speaking shortly with Mahdi Nazim Roy. By the way, Mahdi has written a book, The Globalization of NATO. That's a very important book. The co-author is Dennis Halliday. The article we're going to be discussing with Mahdi is featured at the moment at Global Research, globalresearch.ca. The title is Volgograd and the Conquest of Eurasia. Has the House of Saud seen its Stalingrad? That is an intriguing title. And it's globalresearch.ca. We're going to have to ask him, of course, what happened at Stalingrad. And I think we're joined on the line by Mahdi Nazim Roy. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great. Always a pleasure to talk to you. You've written a wonderful book, Globalization of NATO, together with Dennis Halliday, and you have a featured article at Global Research at the moment. And I want to remind everybody, too, that you, of course, an academic. You've written books and many important articles, but you also were, I have to say, a war correspondent. You went to Libya at a time when the U.S. said it was NATO were providing, ensuring a no-fly zone, but it turned into the bombing of Libya. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. You almost lost your life there. You wrote some really important articles, made great reports. But now, time has gone by. What is the current situation in that liberated country?
Well,
italics on liberated.
Well, liberation is a total wrong word, and of course you were using it with irony there. The country is it's in dissolution. I mean, the east, basically where Cyrenaica is, where the city of Benghazi, which everyone has probably heard about, is located, is virtually its own state. It's got autonomy. The control of the central government that has evolved out of the Transitional National Council that was placed there with foreign armed forces is nominal. So basically the central government's control is nominal. They don't control the east. Oil is stopped. And in fact, I was ridiculed when I did mention this in 2011, before the war, and at the start, I mentioned that the country would essentially be divided to its pre 1969 borders, and that's exactly what has essentially happened. And the reason I said that is because I listened to the U.S. Senate hearings, but from the Intelligence Committee and the Armed Forces Committee, and that's what Mr. Clapper told the U.S. senators, U.S. congressmen who were there. He said that we're going to see the country become divided again to three fiefdoms, essentially, Cyrenaica to the east, Tripolitania to the northwest, and Fezzan to the south, with the border on the border with Chad. And that's what's happened, essentially. Yeah. So this country is now lawless. There is no rule of law. Armed gangs run the streets. There's theft, murder, crime. A country that relatively had a low rate of crime, lower than Canada's when it came to violent crime, now is crime-ridden. I mean, people don't feel safe. Gangs have turf wars. There's no monopoly on weapons by the state. There's armed groups, and we also,
which is a basic definition of civilization, armed monopoly by the state.
I mean, you don't have to agree with some of those points, but I'm describing how the situation is, and this is to the listeners, of course.
Sure.
There's basically no rule of law, no rule of law, no guarantees on safety, no security. Theft is high. There's vengeance, killings, tribalism at its max. All sorts of divisions, all the cleavages there have been magnified and amplified. Yes. Not only that, all the neighboring countries have been destabilized too. We know, of course, where a lot of those weapons that were in Libya's armories went. They went to Mali, you know, they went to Niger, and we have problems there. But those weren't only weapons that were in the Libyan armory. Those were also weapons that were sent there by NATO powers and their allies like Qatar, who were shipping weapons there. Some of those weapons they were sent by countries like France and Britain, ended up going to other places in North Africa and the Sahel. And now we have this domino effect of destabilization that spilled over into Chad, Niger, Mali, even the Central African Republic. They're all really tied. Like, there was a domino effect. And economic instability, of course. There was a manufactured, anthropogenic manufactured famine in Niger because all the agricultural projects were abandoned.
Yes.
So this is the country now. Like, a country that was exporting oil, had no debts, is in debt. Its oil is not being exported all the time. And even the New York Times in September, the New York Times, the voice of modern-day imperialism, with all its imperial messengers, like Friedman, it started. It had an article that featured a map of Syria, how Syria should look like, or Syria of the future. And what do you see? You see those three divisions that they talked about in 2011 that I mentioned and was ridiculed about.
Yeah, it transferred the same kind of show from Libya. And by the way, this is Mahdi Nazim Roya. He has a feature article, Global Research, Volgograd and the Conquest of Eurasia, has the House of Saud seen its Stalingrad, globalresearch.ca. And Nazim, pardon me, I always want to call you Nazim, but my apologies. It's Mahdi Nazim Roya. You, of course, pointed out both at the time of the Libya phenomenon, but then now with the focus moving and fighting into Syria, that there is this sort of godfather figure of Saudi Arabia, which needs to be understood what it is about. You began with it by talking about a man called Bandar Bush and his trip to Moscow. Who's Bandar Bush?
Well, Prince Bandar Ben Sultan is one of the key princes of Saudi Arabia, of the royal family, of the House of Saud. And he was the... How he got the name Bandar Bush is it's a nickname, of course. How he got it was his long relationship with the Bush family, or the Bush dynasty, we might call them.
Yeah, there's a famous picture of him sitting on a sofa, rather weird picture of him and Bush in their tight jeans in an intimate conversation. That I can't erase from my memory, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, neither can I. I think everyone who's heard the name Bandar Bush and knows about this character, as he's best described as, would recognize the picture you're talking about. That shows the intimate relationship he had with the Bush family. The picture is with George Bush Sr., George Herbert Bush, the earlier president of the United States. They had a close relationship in many levels. Intelligence was one of them. He wasn't in the field of intelligence per se as a cabinet minister or as a director of intelligence at the time, but he helped coordinate, as did the entire regime in Saudi Arabia, helped coordinate foreign fighters to enter Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. He's also involved in the events in Bosnia. He's involved in the events in Lebanon before 2011. You know, Seymour Hersh wrote an article very revealing. I think it's very revealing, and it's a perfect example to look at, called The Redirection. Mm-hmm. And it said that while the United States, the Bush 2 administration, is targeting the Iranians and their allies in the Middle East, And because of it, it's resorting to sectarianism, nasty sectarianism, in different parts of the region, trying to turn Shiites against Sunni Muslims, the two major sects of Islam, trying to turn them against each other, mm-hmm. to sow the seeds of discord and sedition.
Could I interrupt you just on that point? Because I know this comes up a lot, and it seems to me you're really touching on something which, when you refer to the New York Times, they really misrepresent. And focusing, for example, on Syria, they make it into, oh, the Shiites and the Sunnis are angry with each other. Yet the government is not doing that, but the Saudi-supported side is, and the U.S. media is reporting it as though, oh, yeah, well, we got these two guys. When, in fact, you have one that wants to be sectarian, right?
Yeah, well, the truth is that this sectarian... this sectarian card, this sectarian description, sectarian fighting is constructed, but the New York Times wants to make it sound natural. It's trying to deceive. The New York Times is trying to deceive its readers, as there's a lot of the mainstream press, to make it sound like these Muslims are genetically programmed, biologically programmed to kill each other. They're programmed to hate each other's sex. There's a ancient blood feud between them. Anybody who believes in that, number one, doesn't know anything about Muslims. Number two, really doesn't know much about the region, and what they do know is superficial. And number three is either lying and spreading propaganda and is in on what's happening. And the New York Times is an excellent example of this. It's trying to now say that the bombings in Lebanon, the assassinations, the car bombings, the murders of Hezbollah officials and of the Hezbollah's rivals, is Hezbollah and its rivals doing it to one another. It's saying that Hezbollah is killing the rivals and they're killing them in Lebanon, the political assassination. And it's trying to base it on, well, that side's Sunnis, this side's Shias. But in reality, one-third of the Sunnis, the last time I checked, supported Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. When I went to the city of Sidon, or Sidon in English, mm-hmm. Third largest city in Lebanon, the head of the Sunni community supported Hezbollah, was a vocal supporter of it. Mm-hmm. In fact, the guys that Saudi Arabia supported, number one, they get a lot of media attention, but they're a minority. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even represent 1% of the city, but yet they get most of the media attention. When they make a statement, it's talked about like, you know, they represent everybody or a good portion of the population. Mm-hmm. I've seen the New York Times say ridiculous things like this. I'm talking about Sheikh Al-Asir, Ahmed Al-Asir, Al-Qaeda-affiliated supporter of the Syrian rebels, tied to the Hariri March 14th Alliance, and given political cover by Mr. Hariri, and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf petrol dictatorships. This man... The New York Times says Sidon has been his traditional turf. Traditional turf? This guy just came into Lebanon a few years ago. I mean, you know, they try to naturalize these things, and they try to construct this storyline about this so-called Alawite regime in Syria that's tied to Iran because the Alawites are an offshoot of Shiism, Shia Islam. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? If you ask a lot of Shiite scholars, they don't even recognize the Alawites as Shiites. From a theological and academic point of view, there's a lot of the jury's out on whether they are Shiites or not. A lot of Shiites don't recognize them as Shiites. Mm-hmm. And even if they were, the government in Syria is not a Shiite government. The government in Syria reflects the actual demographics of the country. Mm-hmm. So the majority of the people in the country are Sunni Muslim Arabs, and thus the majority of the people in the government are Sunni Muslim Arabs. It's very very reflective of the population.
Yeah. Let me ask you about this just to show how the Western media kind of they seriously distort stories. I've seen commentary in Arab publications pointing out that in Iraq there are Islamic, let's just say, extremist elements, violent elements, opposed to the Iraqi government, and the U.S. is supporting the Iraqi government. And in Syria, the same, exact same groups are using terror against the Syrian government, and the U.S. is supporting the terrorists. And yet, the Western media never points that out to us.
No, it doesn't. Actually, it covers it up. The facts are that the United States has funded those groups. Even the Washington Post, which is heavily linked to the CIA, Central Intelligence, Central Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C., has even admitted in the past that the militias in Al-Anbar were bought out by the United States. They basically bought them, and those militias are the nucleus or the nucleolus of these groups, the so-called Islamic groups. These are the nucleuses of that. They've been paid, and the pay has continued. Their paymasters have not just been Washington.
Yes, wasn't that considered
Saudi Arabia? Yeah,
the Petraeus brilliant breakthrough was simply buying half of the militia?
Basically, instead of fighting them, we pay them to fight one another and destabilize the region so we can reconstruct it.
And by the way, once you start doing that, the temptation to keep on is like using drugs, right? Why fight yourself? You could just hire somebody, and he makes trouble wherever you want him to make trouble.
And there's also a lot of money to be made, right, by destabilizing different parts of the world, and the military-industrial complex profits off this. The private contractors, private contractors profit off it.
We can remember seeing planes unloaded with U.S. dollars on by the cartload. They're using forklifts to unload it. Is my memory. And someone said, "Well, whatever happened to that?" And they said, "Well, lost in the bookkeeping. Somebody's got the money." We're talking to Mahdi Nazimroya, and I better focus on bringing it back to the title, which is Volgograd and the Conquest of Eurasia. Has the House of Saud seen its Stalingrad? And what is, there's been a couple of meetings, which people find strange, between Putin of Russia, president, and Prince Bandar Bush. And they're not, we have rumors about what they, and you discussed the rumors in your article, but they haven't, according to the general accounts, been happy meetings, giving rise to the idea that the Saudi family might be threatening the Olympics and that sort of thing. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I do think that there is a threat to the Olympic, terrorist attacks to the Olympics in the North Caucasus. In regards to the Saudi royal family and their involvement in it, well, I can categorically state the House of Saud has supported terrorism against the Russian Federation. You know, historically they have supported, along with the Pakistanis, they've supported and trained these groups. Regardless of whether you support some of these groups or not, because there are variations in them in the North Caucasus, whether they're in Dagestan or Chechnya, regardless of whether one supports them and their bid for independence or separatism, they've been manipulated. They've been used as geopolitical tools. Regardless of if you support them or not, think of them good or bad. I'll let each listener decide what they think about them. Regardless of that, they've been used, and the support they've gained for the support they were given and the aid they've been given by Saudi Arabia, by Pakistan, and by the United States ultimately has been basically to destabilize Russia and to have control around the Caspian Sea Basin. That's the real reason. It's not because the United States has a bleeding heart and wants independence for people all around the world,
yeah.
or for different ethnic groups.
Well, they had a kind of a blowback mess in Boston, which is attributed to U.S. Playing around in Chechnya.
Oh yeah, the young men involved in that. The FBI was in contact with him. The Russians were watching him because they thought he was working for the United States. They made several requests, and the timing of that is very key. The CIA attaché, or the station manager, mm-hmm. the CIA in Moscow, was arrested like a buffoon.
Oh, I remember
wearing
that.
A wig, because he tried to basically buy out or recruit a Russian security official who was in charge of the North Caucasus. So why is the U.S. so focused on the North Caucasus? I mean, it's very simple. It's what they've been trying to do for a long time, is to destabilize that region. And where the Volga is located, the region of the Volga, which has seen three terrorist attacks in the last few months, is in between two major Muslim regions in the Russian Federation. There's one to the north of it. It's on the end, on the fringes of the European portion of Russia, on the borders of Kazakhstan. It's where places like Tartaristan, which is predominantly Muslim, are located, and that's a Muslim area up there. And then to the south, there's the North Caucasus, which is predominantly Muslim, with all these autonomous republics, such as North Ossetia, Alanya Ossetia, Chechnya, Dagestan.
Mm-hmm.
These are Muslim regions. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to flare up these regions. And if these regions are flared up, that region to the north, and that region to the south, and the Volga is the connection between them both, I mean, it'll cut off European Russia from the Asian part of Russia.
Which was, what the German military was attempting to do, wasn't it?
The Germans, the city of Volgograd, or as it was called at the time when the German Third Reich attacked it, Stalingrad, named after Joseph Stalin,
mm-hmm.
the Georgian leader of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
not a Russian. When they attacked it, if they attacked that city, it's very strategic. They would have had they could have gone south and to all the oil routes. They could have got all the oil in the Caucasus, and they could have gone easily into Central Asia.
In terms of strategic outlook, that's really what the West is attempting here.
This is a strategic city. And if there's problems there, it's at the artery. It's in an artery near the Caspian, in the Volga region, between those two Muslim regions. What the United States wants to do is cause sectarianism in Russia too. It wants to turn Christians against Muslims. It very much wants to do that, and that's a huge danger to Russia. And the Russian government realizes that. That's why actually separatism, or spreading separatist ideology in the Russian Federation, is a criminal act now,
mm-hmm.
because they realize that. And unfortunately, there are people in Russia that are forwarding ethnocentric views or views against other Russian citizens,
mm-hmm.
because everybody in... there's Russian citizens and then there's ethnic Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? The lines are very blurry on those things.
Yeah.
Historically, this is a country that's been an empire. Everyone's mixed. Someone has a grandfather from Poland.
Yeah.
Someone has a great-great-grandfather who's Turkic background. Has a mother who's a Muslim and a father who's a Christian, or a grandmother who's a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
or a grandfather who's a Jew.
Yeah.
It's a mixed country where everybody has mixed heritages.
That's what the French, after the revolution, called each other citizen. Nice name.
Citizen, exactly. And the problem is, because of these identity politics and because of these clashes, this question of what is Russian citizen and ethnic Russian is clashing. And the United States wants to see this clash,
mm-hmm.
in Russia. You know, they want to see the Muslims, yep. and the Christians going at it. They want to see the ethnic Russians and the non-ethnic Russians, whether they're Tartars, or Azeris, or
And by the way, let me just in winding up. Your take on it is that they may have misplayed their hand, and the Russians may have the win out in this contest.
I think that definitely the hand's been misplayed. Regardless of whether we blame the House of Saud or not, regardless of whether those reports about Prince Bandar and President Vladimir Putin's meeting are valid and authentic, the fact is that the House of Saud has traditionally supported terrorism, has supported terrorism in Russia along with Washington. The House of Saud has supported the same terrorist groups in Syria that have attacked Russia. Many of those Chechen militants are now, and Dagestani militants are now fighting in Syria.
So the governments
of Russia and Syria have the exact same enemies, and they're fighting the exact same foot soldiers and proxies.
That's a great, I have to leave it there because of time, but that is a great summary. Mahdi Nazemroya, globalresearch.ca, everybody should read this article, Volgograd and the Conquest of Eurasia. Mahdi, hey, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, and good start to 2014.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. Phil and Terry, thanks very much. See you next week.